Growing up in Montana, we cross-country skied a lot. We actually could cross-country ski right out the front door. And I started skiing when I was just over 2 years old. The first person who went out into the fresh powder laid tracks, which meant that they broke through the powder first. And then once the powder was broken, it was much easier for the rest of me and my family to follow. And we would create paths all around the hills and things around our house. And the skied tracks were the slick, smooth tracks, and we could go really fast. The only problem is that the tracks would always be in the same loop. And so you didn't really get to go explore where other people hadn't gone before. But when I was older than two and strong enough, I loved to lay new tracks. Going off into the wilderness, and I didn't have to follow my mom or my dad. And in Montana, skiing fresh powder, and probably in other places too, we called it the cold smoke. And it's liberating to break trail, to break new paths. Now, this is an incomplete metaphor, but it's really one that's helpful to start the reflection on how our brain and our nervous system function and create the thought and emotional patterns that we live with. We have tracks in our minds and in our beings, in our nervous system, that are well worn. And once they've been skied many times, they get faster and faster, and it's easier and easier to fall into those tracks without even noticing. And then even when you want to stop, it can become too slick. And the skiers on the tracks are actually not even us. They're the impulses and desires and judgments and reactivity that are there because of our environment, our family, our social construction, our culture. And they're a product of our biological and sociological and psychological evolution that's led up to our survival, your survival, my survival up until this point. These tracks of thought and emotion that have led to our behaviors and action in the world, that's not you, that's not me, that's not us. And that's why we meditate, is through the practice of meditation, you can realize that you are not these tracks. And you can have the experience of being liberated from being lost in thought and reactivity. And mindfulness gives us the capacity to choose. Do I want to travel on this track? Or do I want to lay a new one and I want to go into the wilderness and explore? Or do I want to take off skis altogether and go in for a hot chocolate? Some definitions, just to be clear, around the difference between meditation and mindfulness, and we'll go deeper into these as we go through today's podcast. Meditation is the practice that strengthens our capacity to be mindful. It returns us to a place of openness and fresh snow. Again and again, through returning to the present moment, we can become aware of the patterns that we've created, of habitual thoughts, emotions, and sensations, and we can choose something new. Each time we return to spacious awareness, we have the opportunity to practice compassion for ourselves, for other people, and to choose mindful response over reactivity. Meditation, and then the applied practice of mindfulness, allows us to show up more fully in our lives. We are more self-aware, more responsible, and more kind, and experience a greater sense of ease, joy, and peace. In today's podcast, we're going to cover what are some common misconceptions around meditation, why develop a meditation practice, what mindfulness is, and we'll look at why self-awareness is a key to liberation, different kinds of meditation, and then learning the different types so that you know what's best for you at this time, and then some tips on how to set up your own practice or to deepen your practice if you already have a meditation practice. So let's dive into some common misconceptions on meditation. The first one is that thoughts and emotions are not bad. The point of meditation is not to have an empty mind with no thoughts or a life with no feelings. That's not the point, and that's not even possible. It wouldn't be a very enjoyable life if we were just numb. And meditation is not goal-oriented. It's not about cultivating a specific state, such as calm or bliss, although you might experience those are often happy byproducts. Meditation is also not about being a good meditator. It's about how it shifts your awareness and then how you experience life and the quality of that experience. There's also this odd westernization of meditation that seems to have occurred to some degree, in which people think that meditation is a tool to be more productive. And it's not to be more productive. You certainly can develop a sense of concentration and focus. And with this intensified concentration and focus and more of an understanding of why you're doing and a deepening into your whys and into your value, you could become much more productive. But that's not the point. The point is not to become more productive. So why do you meditate? Very basic, on a basic level, the quality of your mind determines the quality of your life. And while these are not the goal, the benefits include of meditation, and this is what I've experienced in my life, and of course they're not limited to these, you're going to suffer less, you'll be more free, more at peace, more joy-filled, spontaneous, trusting, and open. It's much easier to shift habits that are not healthy. You'll get sick less, you'll sleep better, have better relationships, accept death, and enjoy life more. Sam Harris says, changing how you respond to the world is often as good as changing the world. Listen to that quote again. Changing how you respond to the world is often as good as changing the world. So much of our lives spent focusing on how if the world was somehow different, we could be happy, we could be at peace. If that person wasn't doing something that was annoying to me, then I would be at peace. If the traffic wasn't so bad, then I would be at peace. But we don't have much control, if any, over the outside world or other people. What we do have some control over, and we can gain more awareness of, is our emotional internal state. You might have heard me in different podcasts, or if you've been in class with me, tell the story of putting on leather shoes versus coating the world in leather. And very simply, if you look out at the world and through life, there's going to be suffering. There is going to be things that are hard, things that are problems, things that are sharp and painful, as if the world has covered with shards of glass and they can cut you. And you have two options. You could try to coat the world entirely in leather and so that it was smooth and yet you didn't get hurt. But that's going to take a lot of work. And I don't know that it's even possible. Or you could put on leather shoes. And that's what meditation does. Meditation allows us to have better conversations with ourselves and experience less suffering. It's checking in instead of checking out, not numbing our feelings, not disengaging from our lives when they're overwhelming, but being really present and fully invested in our lives, feeling everything, but not suffering. Quite simply, and as I said in the introduction, in the metaphor of skiing, you're not your thoughts, your feelings, your emotions, your sensations, or your story. So take a moment now and close your eyes. Notice how your body feels. And of course, if you're driving, please don't close your eyes, but you can still notice how your body feels. Or if you're out for a walk. And bring awareness to your breath focusing either right where the breath is going in through the nose or down in the belly where it is rising and falling and putting some pressure on the abdomen. And then become aware of your thoughts. And I don't want you to think of an elephant. And notice, as soon as I said that, you either had an elephant pop up in your mind and then you tried to erase it, or the word elephant or something related to elephant popped up. You were not in control of that. Thoughts just happen. So the thoughts that just happened, that can't be you. Maybe you've heard of the metaphor of the ocean and the waves, that you are the ocean, which is open, spacious awareness, and thoughts, feelings, sensations, these are the waves in the ocean. And if you identify with the wave, then you forget that you are the whole ocean. Or the awareness is like the sky, and thoughts and sensations and emotions are the weather. And we can remember that we're the sky and be less tossed around by the weather. When we're lost in thought or feeding emotion with story, it's like we're chasing around the tornado. We're chasing around the storm. Whereas if we return to the sky-like open quality of awareness, we can let the weather pass. You cannot keep an emotion going in your system without the support, without the fuel of thought. If you're angry or if you're sad, an emotion given the full expression of its life lasts about 90 seconds. So unless you're fueling it with story, then it's going to rise and fall, and it doesn't need to be something that you are afraid of or that you're trying to suppress. One of the biggest lessons that I have learned in meditation, it teaches us to begin again. And beginning again is coming back to the present moment. That even if you've had a meditation that you've been completely lost in thought, the next moment is an opportunity to begin again. And this is the same in all of life. If you have been in an argument with someone and you're fueling it with story and resentment, you have the opportunity to begin again, reflect on how you want to show up and maybe offer an apology. Or let's say you're having a day and you had a whole bunch of things that you wanted to do, or you really were meaning to get outside, and instead you've spent the day scrolling on your phone and not eating great. If it's not the very end of the day, you can begin again by putting your phone down and going out for a walk. There's always the opportunity to begin again. So what is mindfulness? Mindfulness is the practice skill to be present. A practice that is practicing non-identification with your thoughts and your emotions, and cultivating an open and curious mind and a kind heart in any moment, in all moments. Meditation is the exercise where we're going to learn to be intentionally mindful. That's the formal sitting or standing or sometimes walking practice of cultivating intentional, mindful awareness, resting in a state of non-grasping awareness. Some other words that are often confused or conflated with mindfulness, you might have heard concentration, or some people interchange meditation and mindfulness, being present, or contemplation, or focus. And these are all related to mindfulness, but in this discussion, I want to use them a little bit more precisely. In Pali, the word mindfulness is sati, which means remembering. And some important qualities to define are awareness, attention, focus or concentration, discernment, which is the metacognition of where the focus and concentration are directed, and then awake awareness, which is clear consciousness, the sky mind that is behind untouched, pure, and non-dual awareness. So in order to define these terms, I want to try an exercise. I want you to look at something in your environment and focus on this particular thing. So I'm here in my bedroom recording, and I'm focusing on the pillowcase that is pink and it's shiny. And I'm looking at the pink pillowcase. There is a spotlight of my focus. And this is not a perfect metaphor, but it's where we'll start. What you are focusing on, this focused attention or concentration, that is part of mindfulness, is being able to focus and concentrate. And what you focus on grows. You are virtually always focusing on something. Much of the time, for most people, maybe all of the time, it's mental reconstructions of the past or potential futures that you're focusing on. If you watch where your thoughts are going, usually it's somewhere in the past or somewhere in the future. Your general frame of existence and experience is created by what you focus on repeatedly. So this is like the ski tracks. Wherever you've skied repeatedly is going to have slicker and slicker tracks. What you focus on grows. So it's important to be aware of what you are focusing on. So I'm focusing on this pink pillowcase. And then there's this more peripheral awareness of things that are outside that narrow focus on the pillowcase. This open awareness is also a part of mindfulness. So you've got your focused attention and open awareness. There's a difference, and this is a key difference, between mindfulness and the opposite, which is to be lost in thought. As you're focusing on something, sit in awareness. The thoughts and emotions and judgment and commentary will arise in the mind. So looking at this pink pillowcase, I have other thoughts like, my dear friend Katie gave me that pillowcase. Katie is such a nice woman. I should really reach out to Katie. I wonder how she is. I also am curious about how her son is doing. And then on and on and on. It could be feedback like, I don't like what she's wearing, or how did he get that promotion, or I need to clean the kitchen, or what should I have for lunch? And then there will be sensations that arise in the body that are perhaps paired with these thoughts. So I might look at the pillowcase, but I'm thinking about my friend Katie, and I'll get a warm feeling in my heart, but then I'll feel agitated, and then I'll feel down on myself because I'm not really a great friend because I haven't reached out to her in quite a while. There's all of this feedback and being lost in thought, and it leads to this upswelling feeling of I'm uncomfortable and I need things to be different. And then usually it motivates some sort of behavior. Maybe it could be, I don't want to think about how I haven't called Katie and distract myself, and so I'll go eat some chocolate. Or maybe it will lead me to reach out to Katie and call her, which wouldn't be such a bad thing. But being lost in thought, being identified being with these emotions and thoughts and commentary, that is not helpful. That is where the suffering is. That is where, in Buddhism, the term is dukkha, or unsatisfactoriness, that this present moment is not going to be satisfactory because your thoughts are always telling you that this moment is not enough. And mindfulness is noticing that these thoughts are not you. in the meditation practice and in mindfulness, there is a moment between what you're focusing on and how you are responding. Usually it's automatic reactivity. The sacred pause is the pause between noticing the impulse and then not acting on the reactivity, or noticing the reactivity and responding instead. And this is where discernment comes in. When you notice that you're lost in thought, when you've identified with these judgments, mindfulness is noticing that you've fallen into the tracks, you've fallen into the ski tracks, and then remembering to choose love, to choose compassion, to choose non-judgment and non-attachment. Sati, remembering, this is where the remembering can happen. When you set the intention of living more in alignment with your values. So how does meditation translate to mindfulness? What does mindfulness in action look like? And we're going to talk about self-awareness, the power of self-awareness, neuroplasticity, and how to enact the sacred pause. You can change your brain. It's so cool. You can change your brain. And that's not unique to meditation. Everything changes your brain in some way. Surfing is changing my brain as I learn how to surf. And what you eat changes your brain. TV, social media, these things all change your brain. Being aware of how you would want your brain to change so that you are a more compassionate and kind human being and so that you suffer less. Self-awareness is the key to liberation and peace. This is meeting the moment. Meeting the moment, listening in presence and attuning to the moment without trying to get anything from the moment, without trying to appear in a certain way to others or manipulate to get your way or have the unconscious, subconscious need for something to be different. Mindfulness is the capacity to respond with compassion and joy and gratitude, even when things are not going in a way that is easy or that you would like. Overall, mindfulness in action creates less suffering. One of the most skillful ways I've found in my life is to notice when in my life, my reaction is larger than the stimulus. And I'm going to give you an example. So the example is that my husband asks me a question. The stimulus is, did you turn off the stove? My patterned reactivity, the old track, the old ski track, would be, I feel judged. And my mind would say, does he not think I'm responsible? And then my patterning, I would get annoyed. And I would think he's always trying to tell me what to do. And then in my behavior, I would snap at him and say, yeah, I did. And think he's always telling me what to do and he doesn't trust me. So I have a couple of options. I could try to coat the world in leather. I could try to change the world and say, could you just check the stove instead of asking me? And this is definitely an option, but it makes my well-being dependent on whether or not he changes. And I don't have any control over him. Or what I could do is that he asks, did you turn the stove off? And I take a sacred pause. I take a breath. And I feel the annoyance. If annoyance arises, it's not a problem. Without the story of why I'm annoyed, I know that this annoyance feeling is only going to last a minute and a half. And I can let it go. I can realize I don't want to feel that way and not identify with that feeling and watch the annoyance fade. It's pretty wild. It's pretty cool to be able to do this. It feels like a superpower. And with fairly little practice, it can start to take just a couple of seconds to let the feeling go and not feed it with story or thought. And the new response could simply be, I did. Thank you for checking. If I do find myself playing out this scenario in my mind, it's helpful to take it into reflection and meditation, and I can get better at seeing my assumed entailments. These are the thoughts patterns that I have connected to one another. So these are like the ski trails that connect to one another, the thought patterns that connect to one another. But that does not necessarily mean that they are objectively connected. So the example in this scenario is Andy asks me to turn off the stove, entails that Andy does not trust me or that Andy is judging me. But the only clear factual thing is that Andy asked about the stove. Everything else I have created. The few things that are happening here, one is I'm assuming that he's judging me. And two, I'm assuming that if he judges me, he doesn't love me. And three, I might feel shame or I may feel unloved because of the judgment. And then I get defensive. And then that defensiveness becomes this annoyance and I close down and I react in a way to protect my ego. My identity as a responsible person is in jeopardy. What I'm really trying to do in this scenario is to secure love, but my reactivity actually creates distance if I shut down and I get annoyed and I snap. So meditation and mindfulness gives me the awareness and the spaciousness to choose self-compassion and then to come back into the kitchen, to come back to Andy with a fresh perspective and to begin again. We don't have to take the stove into dinner. So this is the way that new tracks can be laid. And you might have heard the term neuroplasticity. And our neurological programming, our programming in our nervous system and in our brains can change with new inputs. Neurons that fire together, wire together. If every single time Andy asks me to do something, I'm partnering it with feeling judged and then getting annoyed, that response pattern is going to get quicker and quicker. Andy says X, I respond with Y. And we have these all over the place in our lives. I see chocolate, I reach for it. I see something on TV that I don't agree with, I feel angry. I see someone post something on social media about their awesome life, and I feel bad about mine. And this is connecting the stimulus to the reaction through repeated action. And in general, the repeated reaction is either clinging to something, wanting more of something, or avoiding something. And then we unintentionally wire ourselves for suffering because we cannot control the outside world. So all we're doing is in reactive patterns, in clinging to things or pushing things away. We can change our brains, like I said before, and neuroplasticity is the way that our brains change. Brain plasticity. It's the ability of neural networks in the brain to change through growth and reorganization. It's the capacity of our brains to be rewired to function in some way that differs from how it used to function. So we can rewire for less suffering, greater joy, greater kindness, greater self-awareness. Meditation and mindfulness off the cushion give us the opportunity for there to be less reactivity and more space. This leads to less suffering, less discomfort. We can learn to see stimulus, all stimulus, everything in the world, as neutral, not good and not bad. We can decondition the mind and the body from reactive patterns. So, as an example, right now I'm sitting in my bedroom. It's quite warm, just as it is in most parts of the Northern Hemisphere. It's quite warm. And if I'm focused on how I don't like the warmth, how the sweat is uncomfortable, how it's sticky and how it's hot, and then I start to want to be in air conditioning or somewhere else other than this hot, sticky room. All I'm doing is creating my own suffering rather than making friends with the moment, meeting the moment, and just notice without attaching to a story. Watching and witnessing, these are the tools for recognizing the patterns in your mind, and it's on the mat in your formal meditation practice, and it's off the mat in your life. The stories, the thoughts, feelings, sensations, and emotions that arise in the body are often connected to the thoughts, and through meditation, you can start to feel how they're connected to one another. And your individual patterning, your individual ski tracks, how are these loops of thoughts and emotions and sensations connected? And then through meditation, returning, letting it snow, letting it snow, letting it snow. Instead of going down and skiing the tracks, let it snow so that those tracks are not the only options. And you can recognize for yourself, what are your top hits? What are the patterns that you recognize? Now that we've gone over what mindfulness is, what meditation, the benefits of meditation are, let's look at some different types of meditation. And this is not a full, extensive, all types of meditation, but I want to give you an introduction to six different types. The first is Vipassana meditation, which is mindfulness or insight meditation. And this is a clear, non-judgmental, undistracted attention to the contents of consciousness. Vipassana uses the breath as the anchor. So watching and feeling the sensations, the raw sensations of the breath, and witnessing the flow of thoughts, feelings, sensations, and practicing non-attachment. Vipassana requires an alert awareness of the present moment experience. And the method is not about thinking about your experience. It's not thinking about the pain in your hip or the traffic outside, but experiencing the experience. So going into what does this actually feel like in my body without a story. So you can start Vipassana practice quite simply. Set a meditation, well, just set any timer. Just set a timer for 5 minutes. Sit and be with the breath. One breath at a time. And cover the breath with awareness. You'll notice your mind thinking, and you'll inevitably get taken into the tracks of thought. And when you notice that you are skiing around on these tracks, coming back to the present moment and returning to the breath. The second kind of meditation is somatic awareness. And this is body awareness. At the beginning of the yoga nidra that I teach, I start with a body scan, and yoga nidra traditionally starts with a body scan. And somatic awareness or body awareness, there's many different forms, but being aware, the similarity in somatic practices, being aware of the feelings and the sensations in the body, and again, not attaching story, and a curiosity of what things actually feel like. And then listening to the body. And in different somatic practices, this attuning, this listening can help reveal where there might be unconscious, unprocessed feelings, emotions, trauma, memory that can then be brought into a therapeutic space. But just witnessing and being present with the body is somatic awareness, body awareness. And as you do somatic awareness practices, you'll notice parts of the body that you can't feel, which is very interesting, that there are parts of our body that may be numb, especially if we have any sort of past trauma. That disassociation or leaving the body because the body wasn't a safe place to be, somatic practices are wonderful for bringing yourself back into the body and embodying the creature that you inhabit. The third kind of meditation is metta, or loving kindness. And in metta, you're cultivating a specific state of being, which is a loving loving and kind state of being. I think of metta loving kindness as laying new ski tracks. It's done, or it can be practiced with Vipassana meditation in a way that is really skillful and has been really helpful and nourishing and awesome in my own life. Loving feels good. Loving people feels really good. And when you're meditating, starting off with a body scan, then anchoring yourself in the breath, watching the thoughts and feelings returning to the breath, and then cultivating intentionally a state of loving kindness. Traditionally, and often in the guided metta meditations that you'll hear either here or on other apps, you start with sending loving kindness and thoughts of appreciation and well-being to somebody who's easy to love, somebody who inspires love genuinely, so that you can tune into what this actually feels like in your body, that it's not just a cognitive love. It's not just thinking about how much you love someone. It's actually feeling how much you love this person or a pet, and cultivating that feeling, extending it to people that you don't know, extending it to people that maybe you're having a difficult time with, extending it to all humans and all creatures around the world, and giving it to yourself, giving yourself metta, loving kindness, cultivating self-love, self-acceptance. The fourth is non-dual selflessness or non-self meditation. This sort of meditation is understanding the selflessness or no self is needed to recognize for clear insight and release of suffering. So this is turning awareness back on itself, the question, who am I? And following where that leads you. If you say, who am I? Maybe what comes up is the roles that you play. The roles that you play in your life as a spouse, as a daughter, as a student, as a whatever job you do, as a yogi, as a meditator, as a role. But that's not really who you are. And as we've covered in today's podcast, you're not your thoughts or your feelings or your sensations. Those are always changing. And continuing to ask that question, who am I? Looking for the self is one of the quickest ways that I've found to experience that there is no self. It's this open, expansive awareness that's not identified with anything. And the practice of dissolving into the open, awake awareness, I am, I am. The fifth kind of meditation or practice I want to cover today is breath work. And breath work is a whole limb in the eight limbs of yoga, the pranayama practice, and there has been an increased attention and awareness about breath work in the, I think in culture overall, but at least within the community, the yoga communities and other wellness communities that I'm a part of. I absolutely love breath work. It's awesome. Breath work creates very quick shifts in your nervous system, and you can have a complete nervous system reset by bringing yourself into a sympathetic state, which is fight, flight, freeze, and then into a parasympathetic state, which is the rest and digest. And by triggering these different states intentionally through the breath, we can have greater control and awareness of our nervous system. And I'm not affiliated with them in any way. I've really been loving the app Othership. They have a lot of guided breath and meditation, breathing practices and meditation. And I offered a breathing practice recently here on the podcast. If you're interested in breath work, then start to check it out. Make sure that you are aware if you have epilepsy or anything that you're concerned about health-wise, that you don't just dive into. Some of these breathing techniques can be overwhelming if you already suffer from anxiety or other things. So just a word of warning to do your research. And I have found that doing breath work before my meditation practice, it's a game changer. It really is. It puts me into a state of ease and tranquility that could take me up to a half hour or more in meditation to get to, and I can get there in 15 minutes or 5 minutes with breath work. So incorporating 5 minutes, 10 minutes, a half hour of breath work into your daily practices is something that I highly recommend. And breathing practices are also really helpful at night for winding down, calming the nervous system down. So some other kinds of meditation I'm not going to go too in depth today, and I'm sure that you'll have heard of many different others. And if you're curious about other kinds of meditation, please reach out, ask me questions, and I'd love to hear about what your questions or curiosities are. Mantra meditation. This is having a mantra that you repeat in your mind. Transcendental meditation is a form of this. Contemplative meditation, and this is more of a reflection, reflecting on specific things in your life. Visualization, a lot of the practices that I offer here on the podcast and Peaceful by Nature are visualizations. I find that visualizations tap me into some subconscious creativity and help release things that would not otherwise be in my awareness, because visualization and using imagery can help us awaken and become more aware of our subconscious beliefs. So why is it so hard? Why is it so hard? Why is it so hard to just sit there and do nothing, to just be? What gets in the way? Well, quite simply, we are conditioned to do. We're conditioned to do things. And we have this constant productivity voice in our head that we need to be doing something productive. And just sitting there can feel like we're not doing anything and that we should be active in some way. Usually it's because otherwise we think that we are not worthy or that we are going to get behind in some way. Reflect on it. Why do you think that you need to be doing as much as you are doing? It's also really uncomfortable to sit there and realize this barrage and onslaught of thought that is constantly in our minds. It's like this person who's following us around all day long, all day, all night, just with all of the things that we need to do and should do and could do and judgments on everything. It's loud and it's uncomfortable to be radically honest with yourself and maybe to see how you need to be more responsible in the places that you've otherwise blamed the outside world. So it's understandable why it's been hard, if it has been hard for you, to set up a meditation practice. Sitting and doing nothing and being with your thoughts is difficult. And it's one of the most important things that you can do. The entire quality of your life will change when you have a dedicated meditation practice. I didn't have a consistent practice for years, and now I honestly wake up and I'm excited to meditate. And even if it's just for 5 minutes in the morning and 5 minutes in the evening, that's awesome. So, how can you do it? Let's talk about setting up your meditation practice. The first thing is to prioritize it. It is the one thing that can improve everything. So set a goal for yourself and 5 minutes, like I said, 5 minutes a day, set a timer and watch the breath, watch your thoughts. And don't expect the meditation to be good or blissful or revelatory or incredible every single time. And it might not be really awesome for a long time, but bit by bit, you'll notice you have a little bit more space, a little bit more pause throughout your day. And build a space for your meditation. It doesn't need to be a complicated altar or a whole room in your home. Having a space that is simple and that you go to every single time to meditate. It could just be a corner of the couch that is your meditation corner. You can do other things there too, but specifically, if you have a specific place that you meditate, then it will remind you to come back to your meditation practice. You also could set up another trigger for your meditation practice. So I have a Buddha statue, a stone Buddha statue, not very tall, maybe 5 or 6 inches. And it's in my living room. And I meditate in front of that Buddha statue. She's sitting, or they're sitting, in a beautiful, aligned, dignified posture with peace and tranquility on her face. And that's the way that I sit. And that's the spaciousness that I embody when I meditate. Have a time as well as a space that you agree to. And it doesn't need to be a specific time, but somewhere in your routine that is tied to other things that you do on a daily basis. So it could be that you brush your teeth first thing in the morning, and right after you brush your teeth, you meditate for 5 minutes. Or you drink a glass of water before you're going to bed, and right before you go to sleep, you meditate for 5 minutes. Or it could be midday when you are stopping for lunch, that you shut down your computer or you leave your workspace, meditate for 5 minutes, and then have your lunch. Have a set time that's linked to something else so that it falls into the patterns and the rhythms and the rituals that you already have. The next tip is to use guided meditations. I like to do both. I have a daily practice that is sitting with the breath and not listening to anything, because I don't like looking at my phone and having something on my phone first thing in the morning. Although I do sometimes use my phone for a timer, which can be nice. But using a guided meditation is fantastic. It helps you return to the breath and not be so lost in thought. And then you'll start to gain wisdom from people who are guiding the meditations, and you'll hear them in your head as you're doing your own practice and you're not necessarily listening to it. Another thing that I have absolutely loved in my life is meditating outside. Nature naturally has spaciousness, naturally gets us in tune with the breath, with the cycles of life and death, and our interconnectedness with everything, with the web of life. And so meditating out in nature. And the final tip is accountability. Have someone that you meditate with. You could meditate with the people that you live with, or if you have friends that you want to meet up for a weekly meditation, or share on a text thread a yes or a no, whether or not you meditated that day. Some sort of accountability, knowing that other people are meditating and that you're not alone in your practice, helps a lot of people. So there you have it. There's my introduction, my meditation and mindfulness 101. I hope that this was helpful, and I'm curious what you learned and how this impacted you. Do you have a meditation practice? What have been some of your obstacles in setting up a meditation practice? Please reach out and share your feedback, your thoughts, your questions. I love hearing from you. Have a beautiful full August full moon, and I will see you in the new moon for the next practice.